"Certainly not," said Billy. "The army has been discredited by the men who sent us on a secret and illegal mission without the knowledge or consent of Parliament. The hands-off Russia campaign is the necessary first step in returning us to our proper role as the defenders of Great Britain, rather than the private army of a little conspiracy of right-wing generals and politicians." Fitz's chiseled face was red with anger, Billy saw to his great satisfaction. "I think we've heard enough," Fitz said. "The court will now consider its verdict." Murray murmured something and Fitz said, "Oh, yes. Does the accused have anything to say?" Billy stood up. "I call as my first witness, Colonel the Earl Fitzherbert." "Don't be ridiculous," said Fitz. "Let the record show that the court refused to allow me to question a witness, even though he was present at the trial. Get on with it. If I had not been denied my right to call a witness, I would have asked the Colonel what was his relationship with my family. Did he not bear a personal grudge against me because of my father's role as a miners' leader? What was his relationship with my sister? Did he not employ her as his housekeeper, then mysteriously sack her?" Billy was tempted to say more about Ethel, but it would have been dragging her name through the mud, and besides, the hint was probably enough. "I would ask him about his personal interest in this illegal war against the Bolshevik government. Is his wife a Russian princess? Is his son heir to property here? Is the Colonel, in fact, here to defend his personal financial interest? And are all these matters the real explanation of why he has convened a sham of a court? And does that not completely disqualify him from being a judge in this case?" Fitz stared stony-faced, but both Murray and Evans looked startled. They had not known all this personal stuff. Billy said, "I have one more point to make. The German Kaiser stands accused of war crimes. It is argued that he declared war, with the encouragement of his generals, against the will of the German people, as clearly expressed by the representatives in the Reichstag, the German Parliament. By contrast, it is argued, Britain declared war on Germany only after a debate in the House of Commons." Fitz pretended to be bored, but Murray and Evans were attentive. Billy went on, "Now consider this war in Russia. It has never been debated in the British Parliament. The facts are hidden from the British people on the pretense of operational security, always the excuse for the army's guilty secrets. We are fighting, but war has never been declared. The British Prime Minister and his colleagues are in exactly the same position as the Kaiser and his generals. They are the ones acting illegally, not me." Billy sat down. The two captains went into a huddle with Fitz. Billy wondered if he had gone too far. He had felt the need to be trenchant, but he might have offended the captains instead of winning their support. However, there seemed to be dissent among the judges. Fitz was speaking emphatically, and Evans was shaking his head in negation. Murray looked awkward. That was probably a good sign, Billy thought. All the same, he was as scared as he had ever been. When he had faced machine guns at the Somme and experienced an explosion down the pit, he had not been as frightened as he was now, with his life in the hands of malevolent officers. At last, they seemed to reach agreement. Fitz looked at Billy and said, "Stand up." Billy stood. "Sergeant William Williams, this court finds you guilty as charged." Fitz stared at Billy, as if hoping to see on his face the mortification of defeat. But Billy had been expecting a guilty verdict. It was the sentence he feared. Fitz said, "You are sentenced to 10 years penal servitude." Billy could no longer keep his face expressionless. It was not the death penalty. For 10 years. When he came out, he would be 30. It would be 1929. Mildred would be 35. Half their lives would be over. His facade of defiance crumbled, and tears came to his eyes. A look of profound satisfaction came over Fitz's face. "Dismissed," he said. Billy was marched away to begin his prison sentence. Chapter 37. May and June, 1919. On the first day of May, Walter Ulrich wrote a letter to Maud and posted it in the town of Versailles. He did not know whether she was dead or alive. He had heard no news of her since Stockholm. There was still no postal service between Germany and Britain, so this was his first chance of writing to her in 2 years. Walter and his father had travelled to France the day before, with 180 politicians, diplomats, and foreign ministry officials, as part of the German delegation to the peace conference. The French railway had slowed their special train to walking pace as they crossed the devastated landscape of northeastern France.
"As if we were the only ones who fired shells here," Otto said angrily.
From Paris they had been bused to the small town of Versailles and dropped off at the Hôtel des Réservoirs. Their luggage was unloaded in the courtyard and they were rudely told to carry it themselves. Clearly, Walter thought, the French were not going to be magnanimous in victory.
"They didn't win. That's their trouble," said Otto. "They may not have actually lost, not quite, because they were saved by the British and Americans. But that's not much to boast about. We beat them and they know it, and it hurts their pumped-up pride."
The hotel was cold and gloomy, but magnolias and apple trees were in blossom outside. The Germans were allowed to walk in the grounds of the great chateau and visit the shops. There was always a small crowd outside the hotel, the ordinary people who were not as malign as the officials. Sometimes they booed, but mostly they were just curious to look at the enemy. Walter wrote to Maud on the first day. He did not mention their marriage. He was not yet sure it was safe, and anyway, the habit of secrecy was hard to break. He told her where he was, described the hotel and its surroundings, and asked her to write to him by return. He walked into the town, bought a stamp, and posted his letter. He waited in anxious hope for the reply. If she were alive, did she still love him? He felt almost sure she would. But 2 years had passed since she had eagerly embraced him in a Stockholm hotel room. The world was full of men who had returned from war to find their girlfriends and wives had fallen in love with someone else during the long years of separation. A few days later, the leaders of the delegations were summoned to the Hotel Trianon Palace, across the park, and ceremonially handed printed copies of the peace treaty, drafted by the victorious Allies. It was in French. Back at the Hôtel des Réservoirs, the copies were given to teams of translators. Walter was head of one such team. He divided his part into sections, passed them out, and sat down to read. It was even worse than he expected. The French army would occupy the border region of Rhineland for 15 years. The Saar region of Germany was to become a League of Nations protectorate, with the French controlling the coal mines. Alsace and Lorraine were returned to France without a plebiscite. The French government was afraid the population would vote to stay German. The new state of Poland was so large, it took in the homes of 3 million Germans and the coalfields of Silesia. Germany was to lose all her colonies. The Allies had shared them out like thieves dividing the swag, and the Germans had to agree to pay reparations of an unspecified amount, in other words, to sign a blank check. Walter wondered what kind of country they wanted Germany to be. Did they have in mind a giant slave camp where everyone lived on iron rations and toiled only so that the overlords could take the produce? If Walter was to be one such slave, how could he contemplate setting up home with Maud and having children? But worst of all was the war guilt clause. Article 231 of the treaty said, "The Allied and associated governments affirm, and Germany accepts, the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage to which the Allied and associated governments and their nationals have been subjected as a consequence of the war imposed upon them by the aggression of Germany and her allies." "It's a lie," Walter said angrily. "A stupid, ignorant, wicked, vicious, damned lie." Germany was not innocent, he knew, and he had argued as much with his father, time and time again. But he had lived through the diplomatic crises of the summer of 1914. He had known about every small step on the road to war, and no single nation was guilty. Leaders on both sides had been mainly concerned to defend their own countries, and none of them had intended to plunge the world into the greatest war in history. Not Asquith, not Poincaré, nor the Kaiser, nor the Tsar, nor the Austrian Emperor. Even Gavrilo Princip, the assassin of Sarajevo, had apparently been aghast when he understood what he had started. But even he was not responsible for all the loss and damage. Walter ran into his father shortly after midnight, when they were both taking a break, drinking coffee to stay awake and continue working.
"This is outrageous," Otto stormed. "We agreed to an armistice based on Wilson's 14 points, but the treaty has nothing to do with the 14 points.
For once, Walter agreed with his father. By morning, the translation had been printed, and copies had been dispatched by special messenger to Berlin. A classic exercise in German efficiency, Walter thought, seeing his country's virtues more clearly when it was being denigrated. Too exhausted to sleep, he decided to walk until he felt relaxed enough to go to bed. He left the hotel and went into the park. The rhododendrons were in bud. It was a fine morning for France, a grim one for Germany. What effect would the proposals have on Germany's struggling social democratic government? Would the people despair and turn to Bolshevism? He was alone in the great park except for a young woman in a light spring coat, sitting on a bench beneath a chestnut tree. Deep in thought, he touched the brim of his Trilby hat politely as he passed her.
"Walter,"
she said. His heart stopped. He knew the voice, but it could not be her. He turned and stared. She stood up.
"Oh, Walter," she said. "Did you not know me?"
It was Maud. His blood sang in his veins. He took two steps toward her, and she threw herself into his arms. He hugged her hard. He buried his face in her neck and inhaled her fragrance, still familiar despite the years. He kissed her forehead and her cheek and then her mouth. He was speaking and kissing at the same time, but neither words nor kisses could say all that was in his heart. At last she spoke.
"Do you still love me?"
she said.
"More than ever,"
he answered, and he kissed her again. 2. Maud ran her hands over Walter's bare chest as they lay on the bed after making love.
"You're so thin,"
she said. His belly was concave, and the bones of his hips jutted out. She wanted to fatten him on buttered croissants and foie gras. They were in a bedroom at an auberge a few miles outside Paris. The window was open, and a mild spring breeze fluttered the primrose yellow curtains. Maud had found out about this place many years ago when Fitz had been using it for assignations with a married woman, the Comtesse de Cagnes. The establishment, little more than a large house in a small village, did not even have a name. Men made a reservation for lunch and took a room for the afternoon. Perhaps there were such places on the outskirts of London, but somehow the arrangement seemed very French. They called themselves Mr. and Mrs. Wooldridge, and Maud wore the wedding ring that had been hidden away for almost 5 years. No doubt the discreet proprietress assumed they were only pretending to be married. That was all right, as long as she did not suspect Walter was German, which would have caused trouble. Maud could not keep her hands off him. She was so grateful that he had come back to her with his body intact. She touched the long scar on his shin with her fingertips.
"I got that at Chateau Thierry,"
he said.
"Gastour was in that battle. I hope it wasn't he who shot you."
"I was lucky that it healed well. A lot of men died of gangrene." It was 3 weeks since they had been reunited. During that time, Walter had been working around the clock on the German response to the draft treaty, only getting away for half an hour or so each day to walk with her in the park, or sit in the back of Fitz's blue Cadillac while the chauffeur drove them around. Maud had been as shocked as Walter by the harsh terms offered to the Germans. The object of the Paris conference was to create a just and peaceful new world, not to enable the winners to take revenge on the losers. The new Germany should be democratic and prosperous. She wanted to have children with Walter, and their children would be German. She often thought of the passage in the Book of Ruth that began, "Whither thou goest, I will go." Sooner or later, she would have to say that to Walter. However, she had been comforted to learn that she was not the only person who disapproved of the treaty proposals. Others on the Allied side thought peace was more important than revenge. 12 members of the American delegation had resigned in protest. In a British by-election, the candidate advocating a non-vengeful peace had won. The Archbishop of Canterbury had said publicly that he was very uncomfortable and claimed to speak for a silent body of opinion that was not represented in the Hun-hating newspapers. Yesterday the Germans had submitted their counter-proposal, more than 100 closely argued pages based on Wilson's 14 points. This morning the French press was apoplectic. Bursting with indignation, they called the document a monument of impudence and an odious piece of buffoonery.
"They accuse us of arrogance, the French," said Walter.
"What is that phrase about a saucepan?"
"The pot calling the kettle black," said Maud.
He rolled onto his side and toyed with her pubic hair. It was dark and curly and luxuriant. She had offered to trim it, but he said he liked it the way it was.
"What are we going to do?"
he said. "It's romantic to meet in a hotel and go to bed in the afternoon, like illicit lovers, but we cannot do this forever. We have to tell the world we are man and wife." Maud agreed. She was also impatient for the time when she could sleep with him every night, though she did not say so. She was a bit embarrassed by how much she liked sex with him. "We could just set up home and let them draw their own conclusions."
"I'm not comfortable with that,"
he said. It makes us look ashamed. She felt the same. She wanted to trumpet her happiness, not hide it away. She was proud of Walter. He was handsome and brave and extraordinarily clever. We could have another wedding, she said. Get engaged, announce it, have a ceremony, and never tell anyone we've been married almost 5 years. It's not illegal to marry the same person twice. He looked thoughtful. My father and your brother would fight us. They could not stop us, but they could make things unpleasant, which would spoil the happiness of the event. You're right, she said reluctantly. Fitz would say that some Germans may be jolly good chaps, but all the same you don't want your sister to marry one. So we must present them with a fait accompli. Let's tell them, then announce the news in the press, she said. We'll say it's a symbol of the New World Order, an Anglo-German marriage at the same time as the peace treaty. He looked dubious. How would we manage that? I'll speak to the editor of the Tatler magazine. They like me. I've provided them with lots of material. Walter smiled and said, Lady Maud Fitzherbert is always dressed in the latest fashion. What are you talking about? He reached for his billfold on the bedside table and extracted a magazine clipping. My only picture of you, he said. She took it from him. It was soft with age and faded to the color of sand. She studied the photo. This was taken before the war, and it has been with me ever since. Like me, it survived. Tears came to her eyes, blurring the faded image even more. Don't cry, he said, hugging her. She pressed her face to his bare chest and wept. Some women cried at the drop of a hat, but she had never been that sort. Now she sobbed helplessly. She was crying for the lost years, and the millions of boys lying dead, and the pointless, stupid waste of it all. She was shedding all the tears stored up in 5 years of self-control. When it was over, and her tears were dry, she kissed him hungrily, and they made love again. 3. Fitz's blue Cadillac picked Walter up at the hotel on June 16th and drove him into Paris. Maud had decided that the Tatler magazine would want a photograph of the two of them. Walter wore a tweed suit made in London before the war. It was too wide at the waist, but every German was walking around in clothes too big for him. Walter had set up a small intelligence bureau at the Hôtel des Réservoirs, monitoring the French, British, American, and Italian newspapers, and collating gossip picked up by the German delegation. He knew that there were bad-tempered arguments between the Allies about the German counter-proposals. Lloyd George, a politician who was flexible to a fault, was willing to reconsider the draft treaty, but the French Prime Minister, Clemenceau, said he had already been generous and fumed with outrage at any suggestion of amendments. Surprisingly, Woodrow Wilson was also obdurate. He believed the draft was a just settlement, and whenever he had made up his mind, he became deaf to criticism. The Allies were also negotiating peace treaties to cover Germany's partners, Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire. They were creating new countries such as Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, and carving up the Middle East into British and French zones, and they were arguing about whether to make peace with Lenin. In every country the people were tired of war, but a few powerful men were still keen to fight against the Bolsheviks. The British Daily Mail had discovered a conspiracy of international Jewish financiers supporting the Moscow regime, one of that newspaper's more implausible fantasies. On the German treaty, Wilson and Clemenceau overruled Lloyd George, and earlier that day the German team at the Hôtel des Réservoirs had received an impatient note giving them 3 days to accept. Walter thought gloomily about his country's future as he sat in the back of Fitz's car. It would be like an African colony, he thought, the primitive inhabitants working only to enrich their foreign masters. He would not want to raise children in such a place. Maud was waiting in the photographer's studio, looking wonderful in a filmy summer dress that, she said, was by Paul Poiret, her favorite couturier. The photographer had a painted backdrop that showed a garden in full flower, which Maud decided was in bad taste, so they posed in front of his dining room curtains, which were mercifully plain. At first they stood side by side, not touching, like strangers. The photographer proposed that Walter should kneel in front of Maud, but that was too sentimental. In the end they found a position they all liked, with the two of them holding hands and looking at each other, rather than the camera. Copies of the picture would be ready tomorrow, the photographer promised. They went to their auberge for lunch. The Allies can't just order Germany to sign, Maud said. That's not negotiation. It is what they have done. What happens if you refuse? They don't say. What are you going to do? Some of the delegation are returning to Berlin tonight for consultations with our government. He sighed. I'm afraid I have been chosen to go with them. Then this is the time to make our announcement. I'll go to London tomorrow after I've picked up the photographs. All right, he said. I'll tell my mother as soon as I get to Berlin. She'll be nice about it. Then I'll tell father. He won't. I'll speak to Aunt Herm and Princess Bea and write to Fitz in Russia. So this will be the last time we meet for a while. Eat up, then, and let's go to bed. 4. Gus and Rosa met in the Tuileries Gardens. Paris was beginning to get back to normal, Gus thought happily. The sun was shining, the trees were in leaf, and men with carnations in their buttonholes sat smoking cigars and watching the best-dressed women in the world walk by. On one side of the park, the Rue de Rivoli was busy with cars, trucks, and horse-drawn carts. On the other, freight barges plied the River Seine. Perhaps the world would recover after all. Rosa was ravishing in a red dress of light cotton and a wide-brimmed hat. If I could paint, Gus thought when he saw her, I'd paint her like this. He had a blue blazer and a fashionable straw boater. When she saw him, she laughed. What is it? He said. Nothing. You look nice. It's the hat, isn't it? She suppressed another giggle. You're adorable. It looks stupid. I can't help it. Hats do that to me. It's because I'm shaped like a ball-peen hammer. She kissed him lightly on the lips. You're the most attractive man in Paris. The amazing thing was that she meant it. Gus thought, how did I get so lucky? He took her arm. Let's walk. They strolled toward the Louvre. She said, have you seen The Tatler? The London magazine? No. Why? It seems that your intimate friend, Lady Maud, is married to a German. Oh, he said. How did they find out? You mean you knew about this? I guessed. I saw Walter in Berlin in 1916, and he asked me to carry a letter to Maud. I figured that meant they were either engaged or married. How discreet you are. You never said a word. It was a dangerous secret. It may still be dangerous. The Tatler is nice about them, but other papers may take a different line. Maud has been attacked by the press before now. She's pretty tough. Rosa looked abashed. I suppose this is what you were talking about that night I saw you tête-à-tête with her. Exactly. She was asking me if I had heard any news about Walter. I feel foolish for suspecting you of flirting. I forgive you, but reserve the right to recall the matter next time you criticize me unreasonably. Can I ask you something? Anything you like, Gus. 3 questions, in fact. How ominous. Like a folk tale. If I get the answers wrong, will I be banished? Are you still an anarchist? Would it bother you? I guess I'm asking myself if politics might divide us. Anarchism is the belief that no one has the right to rule. All political philosophies, from the divine right of kings to Rousseau's social contract, try to justify authority. Anarchists believe that all those theories fail. Therefore, no form of authority is legitimate. Irrefutable in theory, impossible to put into practice. You're quick on the uptake. In effect, all anarchists are anti-establishment, but they differ widely in their vision of how society should work. And what is your vision? I don't see it as clearly as I used to. Covering the White House has given me a different slant on politics, but I still believe that authority needs to justify itself. I don't think we'll ever quarrel about that. Good. Next question. Tell me about your eye. I was born like this. I could have an operation to open it. Behind my eyelid is nothing but a mass of useless tissue, but I could wear a glass eye. However, it would never shut. I figure this is the lesser evil. Does it bother you? He stopped walking and turned to face her directly. May I kiss it? She hesitated. All right. He bent down and kissed her closed eyelid. There was nothing unusual about how it felt to his lips. It was just like kissing her cheek. Thank you, he said. She said quietly, no one has ever done that before. He nodded. He had guessed it might be some kind of taboo. She said, why did you want to do it? Because I love everything about you, and I want to make sure you know it. Oh. She was silent for a minute, in the grip of emotion. But then she grinned and reverted to the flip tone she preferred. Well, if there's anything else weird you want to kiss, just let me know. He was not sure how to respond to that vaguely exciting offer, so he filed it away for future consideration. I have one more question.
Shoot.
4 months ago I told you that I love you. I haven't forgotten, but you haven't said how you feel about me. Isn't it obvious?
Perhaps.
But I'd like you to tell me. Do you love me?
Oh, Gus, don't you understand?
Her face changed and she looked anguished.
I'm not good enough for you.
You were the most eligible bachelor in Buffalo, and I was the one-eyed anarchist. You're supposed to love someone elegant and beautiful and rich. I'm a doctor's daughter. My mother was a housemaid. I'm not the right person for you to love.
Do you love me?
He said with quiet persistence. She began to cry.
Of course I do, you dope. I love you with all my heart.
He put his arms around her. Then that's all that matters, he said. 5. Aunt Ham put down the Tatler.
It was very bad of you to get married secretly, she said to Maud. Then she smiled conspiratorially. But so romantic.
They were in the drawing room of Fitz's Mayfair house. Bayer had redecorated after the end of the war, in the new Art Deco style, with utilitarian-looking chairs and modernistic silver gewgaws from Asprey. With Maud and Herm were Fitz's roguish friend Bing Westhampton and Bing's wife. The London season was in full swing, and they were going to the opera as soon as Bayer was ready. She was saying goodnight to Boy, now 3 and a half, and Andrew, 18 months. Maud picked up the magazine and looked again at the article. The picture did not greatly please her. She had imagined that it would show two people in love. Unfortunately, it looked like a scene from a moving picture show. Walter appeared predatory, holding her hand and gazing into her eyes like a wicked Lothario, and she seemed like the ingenue about to fall for his wiles. However, the text was just what she had hoped for. The writer reminded readers that Lady Maud had been the fashionable suffragette before the war. She had started the Soldier's Wife newspaper to campaign for the rights of the women left at home, and she had gone to jail for her protest on behalf of Jane McCully. It said that she and Walter had intended to announce their engagement in the normal way, and had been prevented by the outbreak of war. Their hasty, secret marriage was portrayed as a desperate attempt to do the right thing in abnormal circumstances. Maud had insisted on being quoted exactly, and the magazine had kept its promise. I know that some British people hate the Germans, she had said, but I also know that Walter and many other Germans did all they could to prevent the war. Now that it is over, we must create peace and friendship between the former enemies, and I truly hope people will see our union as a symbol of the new world. Maud had learned, in her years of political campaigning, that you could sometimes win support from a publication by giving it a good story exclusively. Walter had returned to Berlin as planned. The Germans had been jeered by crowds as they drove to the railway station on their way home. A female secretary had been knocked out by a thrown rock. The French comment had been, "Remember what they did to Belgium." The secretary was still in hospital. Meanwhile, the German people were angrily against signing the treaty. Bing sat next to Maud on the sofa. For once he was not flirtatious. "I wish your brother were here to advise you about this," he said with a nod at the magazine. Maud had written to Fitz to break the news of her marriage, and had enclosed the clipping from the Tatler, to show him that what she had done was being accepted by London society. She had no idea how long it would take for her letter to get to wherever Fitz was, and she did not expect a reply for months. By then it would be too late for Fitz to protest. He would just have to smile and congratulate her. Now Maud bristled at the implication that she needed a man to tell her what to do. What could Fitz possibly say? For the foreseeable future, the life of a German wife is going to be hard.
I don't need a man to tell me that.
In Fitz's absence, I feel a degree of responsibility.
Please don't.
Maud tried not to be offended. What advice could Bing possibly offer anyone, other than how to gamble and drink in the world's night spots? He lowered his voice.
I hesitate to say this, but...
He glanced at Aunt Herm, who took the hint and went to pour herself a little more coffee.
If you were able to say that the marriage had never been consummated, then there might be an annulment.
Maud thought of the room with the primrose yellow curtains, and had to suppress a happy smile.
But I cannot. Please don't tell me anything about it. I only want to make sure you understand your options.
Maud suppressed a growing indignation.
I know this is kindly meant, Bing,
There is also the possibility of divorce. There is always a way, you know, for a man to provide a wife with grounds. Maud could no longer contain her outrage.
"Please drop the subject instantly," she said in a raised voice. "I have not the slightest wish for either an annulment or a divorce. I love Walter."
Bing looked sulky. "I was just trying to say what I think Fitz, as the head of your family, might tell you if he were here." He stood up and spoke to his wife. "We'll go on, shall we? No need for all of us to be late." A few minutes later, Bea came in wearing a new dress of pink silk.
"I'm ready," she said, as if she had been waiting for them rather than the other way around.
Her glance went to Maud's left hand and registered the wedding ring, but she did not comment. When Maud told her the news, her response had been carefully neutral. "I hope you will be happy," she had said without warmth, "and I hope Fitz will be able to accept the fact that you did not get his permission." They went out and got into the car. It was the black Cadillac Fitz had bought after his blue one got stranded in France. Everything was provided by Fitz, Maud reflected. The house the three women lived in, the fabulously expensive gowns they were wearing, the car, and the box at the opera. Her bills at the Ritz in Paris had been sent to Albert Solman, Fitz's man of business here in London, and paid without question. Fitz never complained. Walter would never be able to keep her in such style, she knew. Perhaps Bing was right, and she would find it hard to do without her accustomed luxury. But she would be with the man she loved. They reached Covent Garden at the last minute, because of Bea's tardiness. The audience had already taken their seats. The three women hurried up the red-carpeted staircase and made their way to the box. Maud suddenly remembered what she had done to Walter in this box during Don Giovanni. She felt embarrassed. What had possessed her to take such a risk? Bing Westhampton was already there with his wife, and he stood up and held a chair for Bea. The auditorium was silent. The show was about to begin. People watching was one of the attractions of the opera, and many heads turned to look as the princess took her seat. Aunt Herm sat in the second row, but Bing held a front-row seat for Maud. A murmur of comment rose from the stalls. Most of the crowd would have seen the photograph and read the article in The Tatler. Many of them knew Maud personally. This was London society. The aristocrats and the politicians, the judges and the bishops, the successful artists and the wealthy businessmen, and their wives. Maud stood for a moment to let them get a good look at her, and see how pleased and proud she was. That was a mistake. The sound from the audience changed. The murmur became louder. No words could be made out, but all the same the voices took on a note of disapproval, like the change in the buzz of a fly when it encounters a closed window. Maud was taken aback. Then she heard another noise, and it sounded dreadfully like a hiss. Confused and dismayed, she sat down. That made no difference. Everyone was staring at her now. The hissing spread through the stalls in seconds, then began in the circle, too. "I say," said Bing in feeble protest. Maud had never encountered such hatred, even at the height of the suffragette demonstrations. There was a pain in her stomach like a cramp. She wished the music would start, but the conductor, too, was staring at her, his baton held at his side. She tried to stare proudly back at them all. But tears came to her eyes and blurred her vision. This nightmare would not end of its own accord. She had to do something. She stood up, and the hissing grew louder. Tears ran down her face. Almost blind, she turned around. Knocking her chair over, she stumbled toward the door at the back of the box. Aunt Herm got up, saying, "Oh dear, dear, dear." Bing leaped up and opened the door. Maud went out with Aunt Herm close behind. Bing followed them out. Behind her, Maud heard the hissing die away amid a few ripples of laughter. Then, to her horror, the audience began to clap, congratulating themselves on having got rid of her. And their jeering applause followed her along the corridor, down the stairs and out of the theatre. Six. The drive from the park gate to the Palace of Versailles was a mile long. Today it was lined with hundreds of mounted French cavalrymen in blue uniforms. The summer sun glinted off their steel helmets. They held lances with red and white pennants that rippled in the warm breeze. Johnny Remarque had been able to get Maud an invitation to the signing of the peace treaty, despite her disgrace at the opera. But she had to travel on the back of an open lorry, packed in with all the female secretaries from the British delegation, like sheep going to market. At one moment it had looked as if the Germans would refuse to sign. The war hero, Field Marshal von Hindenburg, had said he would prefer honorable defeat to a disgraceful peace. The entire German cabinet had resigned rather than agreed to the treaty. So had the head of their delegation to Paris. At last, the National Assembly had voted for signing everything except the notorious war guilt clause. Even that was unacceptable, the Allies had said immediately. What will the Allies do if the Germans refuse? Maud had said to Walter in their auberge, where they were now discreetly living together. They say they will invade Germany. Maud shook her head. Our soldiers would not fight, nor would ours, so it would be a stalemate. Except that the British Navy has not lifted the blockade, so Germany still cannot get supplies. The Allies would just wait until food riots broke out in every German city, then they would walk in unopposed. So you have to sign. Sign or starve, said Walter bitterly. Today was June 28th, 5 years to the day since the Archduke had been killed in Sarajevo. The lorry took the secretaries into the courtyard, and they got down as gracefully as they could. Maud entered the palace and went up the grand staircase, flanked by more overdressed French soldiers, this time the Garde Républicaine, in silver helmets with horsehair plumes. Finally she entered the Hall of Mirrors. This was one of the most grandiose rooms in the world. It was the size of 3 tennis courts in a line. Along one side, 17 long windows overlooked the garden. On the opposite wall, the windows were reflected by 17 mirrored arches. More importantly, this was the room where, in 1871, at the end of the Franco-Prussian War, the victorious Germans had crowned their first emperor and forced the French to sign away Alsace and Lorraine. Now the Germans were to be humiliated under the same barrel-vaulted ceiling. And no doubt, some among them would be dreaming of the time in the future when they, in turn, would take their revenge. The degradation to which you subject others comes back, sooner or later to haunt you, Maud thought. Would that reflection occur to men on either side at today's ceremony? Probably not. She found her place on one of the red plush benches. There were dozens of reporters and photographers, and a film crew with huge movie cameras to record the event. The bigwigs entered in ones and twos and sat at a long table. Clemenceau, relaxed and irreverent, Wilson, stiffly formal, Lloyd George like an aging bantam cock. Gus Duer appeared and spoke in Wilson's ear, then went over to the press section and spoke to a pretty young reporter with one eye. Maud remembered seeing her before. Gus was in love with her, Maud could tell. At 3 o'clock, someone called for silence, and a reverent hush fell. Clemenceau said something. A door opened, and the 2 German signatories came in. Maud knew, from Walter, that no one in Berlin had wanted to put his name to the treaty, and in the end they had sent the foreign minister and the postal minister. The 2 men looked pale and ashamed. Clemenceau made a short speech, then beckoned the Germans forward. Both men took fountain pens from their pockets and signed the paper on the table. A moment later, at a hidden signal, guns boomed outside, telling the world that the peace treaty had been signed. The other delegates came up to sign, not just from the major powers, but from all the countries who were party to the treaty. It took a long time, and conversation broke out among the spectators. The Germans sat stiffly frozen until at last it was over and they were escorted out. Maud was sick with disgust. We preached a sermon of peace, she thought, but all the time we were plotting revenge. She left the palace. Outside, Wilson and Lloyd George were being mobbed by rejoicing spectators. She skirted the crowd, made her way into the town, and went to the Germans' hotel. She hoped Walter was not too cast down. It had been a dreadful day for him. She found him packing. We're going home tonight, he said, the whole delegation. So soon. She had hardly thought about what would happen after the signing. It was an event of such huge dramatic significance that she had been unable to look beyond it. By contrast, Walter had thought about it, and he had a plan. Come with me, he said simply. I can't get permission to go to Germany. Whose permission do you need? I've got you a German passport in the name of Frau Maud von Ulrich. She felt bewildered. How did you manage that? She said, though that was hardly the most important question in her mind. It was not difficult. You are the wife of a German citizen. You are entitled to a passport. I used my special influence only to shorten the process to a matter of hours. She stared at him. It was so sudden. Will you come? He said. She saw in his eyes a terrible fear. He thought she might back out at the last minute. His terror of losing her made her want to cry. She felt very fortunate to be loved so passionately. Yes, she said. Yes, I will come. Of course, I will come. He was not convinced. Are you sure this is what you want? She nodded. Do you remember the story of Ruth? In the Bible?
Of course. Why?
Maud had read it several times in the last few weeks, and now she quoted the words that had so moved her.
Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest.
She stopped, unable to speak for the constriction of her throat. Then, after a moment, she swallowed hard and resumed.
Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried.
He smiled, but there were tears in his eyes.
Thank you,
he said.
I love you, she said. What time is the train?
Chapter 38. August to October, 1919. Gus and Rosa returned to Washington at the same time as the president. In August, they contrived to get simultaneous leave and went home to Buffalo. The day after they arrived, Gus brought Rosa to meet his parents. He was nervous. He desperately wanted his mother to like Rosa. But Mother had an inflated opinion of how attractive her son was to women. She had found fault with every girl he had ever mentioned. No one was good enough, especially socially. If he wanted to marry the daughter of the King of England, she would probably say, "Can't you find a nice, well-bred American girl?" "The first thing you'll notice about her, Mother, is that she's very pretty," Gus said at breakfast that morning. "Second, you'll see that she has only one eye. After a few moments, you'll realize that she's very smart, and when you get to know her well, you'll understand that she's the most wonderful young woman in the world."
"I'm sure I shall," said his mother with her accustomed breathtaking insincerity. "Who are her parents?"
Rosa arrived at mid-afternoon, when Mother was taking her nap and Father was still downtown. Gus showed her around the house and grounds. She said nervously, "You do know that I come from a more modest background?"
"You'll get used to it soon enough," he said.
"Anyway, you and I won't be living in this kind of splendor, but we might buy an elegant small house in Washington." They played tennis. It was an uneven match. Gus, with his long arms and legs, was too good for her, and her judgment of distance was erratic. But she fought back determinedly, going for every ball, and won a few games. And in a white tennis dress with the fashionable mid-calf hemline, she looked so sexy that Gus had to make a major effort of will to concentrate on his shots. They went in for tea in a glow of perspiration.
"Summon up your reserves of tolerance and goodwill," Gus said outside the drawing room. "Mother can be an awful snob."
But Mother was on her best behavior. She kissed Rosa on both cheeks and said, "How wonderfully healthy you both look, all flushed with exercise. Miss Hellman, I'm so glad to meet you, and I hope we're going to become friends."
"You're very kind," said Rosa. "It would be a privilege to be your friend."
Mother was pleased by the compliment. She knew she was a grand dame of Buffalo society, and she felt it was appropriate that young women should show her deference. Rosa had divined that in an instant. Clever girl, Gus thought. And generous, too, given that in her heart she hated all authority.
"I know Fritz Hellman, your brother," Mother said.
Fritz played violin in the Buffalo Symphony Orchestra. Mother was on the board. "He has a wonderful talent."
"Thank you. We are very proud of him."
Mother made small talk and Rosa let her take the lead. Gus could not help remembering that once before he had brought home a girl he planned to marry, Olga Vyalov. Mother's reaction then had been different. She had been courteous and welcoming, but Gus had known her heart was not in it. Today she seemed genuine. He had asked his mother about the Vyalov family yesterday. Lev Peshkov had been sent to Siberia as an army interpreter. Olga did not go to many social events and seemed taken up with raising their child. Joseph had lobbied Gus's father, the senator, for more military aid to the whites. "He seems to think the Bolsheviks will be bad for the Vyalov family business in Petrograd," Mother had said.
"That's the best thing I've heard about the Bolsheviks," Gus had replied.
After tea, they went off to change. Gus was disturbed by the thought of Rosa showering in the next room. He had never seen her naked. They had spent passionate hours together in her Paris hotel room, but they had not gone as far as sexual intercourse.
"I hate to be old-fashioned," she had said apologetically, "but somehow I feel we should wait."
She was not much of an anarchist, really. Her parents were coming for dinner. Gus put on a short tuxedo jacket and went downstairs. He mixed a scotch for his father, but did not have one himself. He felt he might need his wits about him. Rosa came down in a black dress and looked stunning. Her parents appeared on the dot of 6 o'clock.
Norman Hellman was wearing white tie and tails, not quite right for family dinner, but perhaps he did not own a tuxedo.
He was an elf of a man with a charming grin, and Gus saw immediately that Rosa took after him.
He drank two martinis rather quickly, the only sign that he might be tense, but then he refused any more alcohol. Rose's mother Hilda was a slender beauty with lovely long-fingered hands. It was hard to imagine her as a housemaid. Gus's father took to her immediately. As they sat down to eat, Dr. Hellman said, "What are your career plans, Gus?" He was entitled to ask this as the father of the woman Gus loved, but Gus did not have much of an answer. "I'll work for the president as long as he needs me," he said. "He's got a tough job on his hands right now."
"That's true. The Senate is making trouble about approving the Versailles peace treaty." Gus tried not to sound too bitter. After all Wilson did to persuade the Europeans to set up the League of Nations, I can hardly believe that Americans are turning up their noses at the whole idea.
"Senator Lodge is a formidable troublemaker." Gus thought Senator Lodge was an egocentric son of a bitch. The president decided not to take Lodge with him to Paris, and now Lodge is getting his revenge. Gus's father, who was an old friend of the president as well as a senator, said, "Woodrow made the League of Nations part of the peace treaty, thinking we could not possibly reject the treaty, therefore we would have to accept the League." He shrugged. Lodge told him to go to blazes. Dr. Hellman said, "In fairness to Lodge, I think the American people are right to be concerned about Article 10. If we join a league that guarantees to protect its members from aggression, we're committing American forces to unknown conflicts in the future." Gus's reply was quick. "If the League is strong, no one will dare to defy it." "I'm not as confident as you about that." Gus did not want to have an argument with Rose's father, but he felt passionately about the League of Nations. "I don't say there would never be another war," he said in a conciliatory tone. "I do think that wars would be fewer and shorter, and aggressors would gain little reward." "And I believe you may be right, but many voters say, 'Never mind the world, I'm interested only in America.' Are we in danger of becoming the world's policeman? It's a reasonable question." Gus struggled to hide his anger. The League was the greatest hope for peace that had ever been offered to humankind, and it was in danger of being stillborn because of this kind of narrow-minded quibble. He said, "The Council of the League has to make unanimous decisions, so the United States would never find itself fighting in a war against its will. Nevertheless, there's no point in having the League unless it is prepared to fight." The enemies of the League were like this. First they complained that it would fight, then they complained it would not. Gus said, "These problems are minor by comparison with the death of millions." Dr. Hellman shrugged, too polite to press his point against such a passionate opponent. "In any case," he said, "I believe a foreign treaty requires the support of 2/3 of the Senate." "And right now we don't even have half," said Gus gloomily. Rosa, who was reporting on this issue, said, "I count 40 in favor, including you, Senator Dewar. 43 have reservations, 8 are implacably against, and 5 undecided." Her father said to Gus, "So, what will the president do?" "He's going to reach out to the people over the heads of the politicians. He's planning a 10,000-mile tour of the entire country. He'll make more than 50 speeches in 4 weeks. A punishing schedule. He's 62 and has high blood pressure." There was a touch of mischief in Dr. Hellman. Everything he said was challenging. Obviously, he felt the need to test the mettle of a suitor for his daughter. Gus replied, "But at the end of it, the president will have explained to the people of America that the world needs the League of Nations to make sure we never fight another war like the one just ended." "I pray you're right. If political complexities need to be explained to ordinary people, Wilson is the best." Champagne was served with dessert. "Before we begin, I'd like to say something," Gus said. His parents looked startled. He never made speeches. "Doctor and Mrs. Hellman, you know that I love your daughter, who is the most wonderful girl in the world. It's old-fashioned, but I want to ask your permission." He took from his pocket a small red leather box. "Your permission to offer her this engagement ring." He opened the box. It contained a gold ring with a single 1-carat diamond. It was not ostentatious, but the diamond was pure white, the most desirable color in a round, brilliant cut, and it looked fabulous. Rosa gasped. Dr. Hellman looked at his wife, and they both smiled. "You most certainly have our permission," he said.
Gus walked around the table and knelt beside Rosa's chair.
"Will you marry me, dear Rosa?" he said.
"Oh, yes, my beloved Gus. Tomorrow, if you like." He took the ring from the box and slid it onto her finger.
"Thank you,"
he said. His mother began to cry. 2. Gus was aboard the President's train as it steamed out of Union Station in Washington, D.C. at 7 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday, September 3rd. Wilson was dressed in a blue blazer, white pants, and a straw boater. His wife, Edith, went with him, as did Carrie Travers Grayson, his personal physician. Also aboard were 21 newspaper reporters, including Rosa Hellman. Gus was confident Wilson could win this battle. He had always enjoyed the direct connection with voters, and he had won the war, hadn't he? The train traveled overnight to Columbus, Ohio, where the president made his first speech of the tour. From there he went on, making whistle-stop appearances along the way, to Indianapolis, where he spoke to a crowd of 20,000 people that evening. But Gus was disheartened at the end of the first day. Wilson had spoken poorly. His voice was husky. He used notes. He was always better when he managed without them, and as he got into the technicalities of the treaty that had so absorbed everyone in Paris, he seemed to ramble and lose the audience's attention. He had a bad headache, Gus knew, so bad that sometimes his vision blurred. Gus was sick with worry. It was not just that his friend and mentor was ill. There was more at stake. America's future and the world's hung on what happened in the next few weeks. Only Wilson's personal commitment could save the League of Nations from its small-minded opponents. After dinner, Gus went to Rosa's sleeping compartment. She was the only female reporter on the trip, so she had a room to herself. She was almost as keen on the League as Gus, but she said, "It's hard to find much positive to say about today." They lay on her bunk, kissing and cuddling. Then they said goodnight and parted. Their wedding was set for October, after the president's trip. Gus would have liked it to be even sooner, but the parents wanted time to prepare, and Gus's mother had muttered darkly about indecent haste, so he had given in. Wilson worked on improvements to his speech, tapping on his old Underwood typewriter as the endless open plains of the Midwest sped by the windows. His performances got better over the next few days. Gus suggested he try to make the treaty relevant to each city. Wilson told business leaders in St. Louis that the treaty was needed to build up world trade. In Omaha, he said the world, without the treaty, would be like a community with unsettled land titles, or the farmers sitting on fences with shotguns. Instead of long explanations, he rammed home the main points in short statements. Gus also suggested that Wilson appeal to people's emotions. This was not just about policy, he said. It touched on their feelings about their country. At Columbus, Wilson spoke of the boys in khaki. In Sioux Falls, he said he wanted to redeem the sacrifices of mothers who had lost their sons on the battlefield. He rarely descended to scurrility, but in Kansas City, home of the vitriolic Senator Reed, he compared his opponents to the Bolsheviks, and he thundered out the message again and again that if the League of Nations failed, there would be another war. Gus smoothed relations with the reporters on board and the local men wherever the train stopped. When Wilson spoke without a prepared speech, his stenographer would produce an immediate transcript, which Gus distributed. He also persuaded Wilson to come forward to the club car now and again to chat informally with the press. It worked. Audiences responded better and better. The press coverage continued mixed, but Wilson's message was repeated constantly even in papers that opposed him, and reports from Washington suggested that opposition was weakening. But Gus could see how much the campaign was costing the president. His headaches became almost continuous. He slept badly. He could not digest normal food, and Dr. Grayson fed him liquids. He got a throat infection that developed into something like asthma, and he began to have trouble breathing. He tried to sleep sitting upright. All of this was kept from the press, even Rosa. Wilson continued to give speeches, although his voice was weak. Thousands cheered him in Salt Lake City, but he looked drawn, and he clenched his hands repeatedly in an odd gesture that made Gus think of a dying man. Then, on the night of September 25th, there was a commotion. Gus heard Edith calling for Dr. Grayson. He put on a dressing gown and went to the president's car. What he saw there horrified and saddened him. Wilson looked dreadful. He could hardly breathe and had developed a facial twitch. Even so, he wanted to carry on. But Grayson was adamant that he call off the remainder of the tour, and in the end Wilson gave in. Next morning Gus, with a heavy heart, told the press that the president had suffered a severe nervous attack, and the tracks were cleared to speed the 1,700-mile journey back to Washington. All presidential engagements were cancelled for 2 weeks, notably a meeting with pro-treaty senators to plan the fight for confirmation. That evening, Gus and Rosa sat in her compartment, disconsolately looking out of the window. People gathered at every station to watch the president go by. The sun went down, but still the crowd stood and stared in the twilight. Gus was reminded of the train from Brest to Paris, and the silent multitude that had stood beside the tracks in the middle of the night. It was less than a year ago, but already their hopes had been dashed. "We did our best," Gus said, "but we failed."
"Are you sure?"
"When the president was campaigning full-time, it was touch and go. With Wilson sick, the chance of the treaty being ratified by the Senate is zero." Rosa took his hand.
"I'm sorry," she said, "for you, for me, for the world."
She paused, then said, "What will you do?"
"I'd like to join a Washington law firm specializing in international law. I've got some relevant experience, after all."
"I should think they'll be lining up to offer you a job, and perhaps some future president will want your help."
He smiled. Sometimes she had an unrealistically high opinion of him. "And what about you?"
"I love what I'm doing. I hope I can carry on covering the White House."
"Would you like to have children?"
"Yes."
"So would I." Gus stared meditatively out of the window. "I just hope Wilson is wrong about them."
"About our children?"
She heard the note of solemnity in his tone, and she asked in a frightened voice,
"What do you mean?"
"He says they will have to fight another world war."
"God forbid,"
Rosa said fervently. Outside, night was falling. Chapter 39. January 1920. Daisy sat at the table in the dining room of the Vyaloff family's prairie house in Buffalo. She wore a pink dress. The large linen napkin tied around her neck swamped her. She was almost 4 years old, and Lev adored her.
"I'm going to make the world's biggest sandwich," he said, and she giggled.
He cut 2 pieces of toast half an inch square, buttered them carefully, added a tiny portion of the scrambled eggs Daisy did not want to eat, and put the slices together.
"It has to have 1 grain of salt," he said.
He poured salt from the cellar onto his plate, then delicately picked up a single grain on the tip of his finger and put it on the sandwich.
"Now I can eat it," he said.
"I want it," said Daisy.
"Really? But isn't it a daddy-sized sandwich?"
"No,"
she said, laughing.
"It's a girl-sized sandwich."
"Oh, all right," he said, and popped it into her mouth. "You don't want another one, do you?"
"Yes."
"But that one was so big."
"No, it wasn't."
"Okay, I guess I have to make another one."
Lev was riding high. Things were even better than he had told Grigori 10 months ago when they had sat in Trotsky's train. He was living in great comfort in his father-in-law's house. He managed 3 Vyaloff nightclubs, getting a good salary plus extras such as kickbacks from suppliers. He had installed Marga in a fancy apartment, and he saw her most days. She had got pregnant within a week of his return, and she had just given birth to a boy, whom they had named Grigori. Lev had succeeded in keeping the whole thing secret. Olga came into the dining room, kissed Daisy, and sat down. Lev loved Daisy, but he had no feelings for Olga. Marga was sexier and more fun, and there were plenty more girls, as he had found out when Marga was heavily pregnant.
"Good morning, mummy," Lev said gaily.
Daisy took her cue and repeated his words. Olga said,
"Is Daddy feeding you?"
These days they talked like this, mainly through the child. They had had sex a few times when Lev got back from the war, but they had soon reverted to their normal indifference, and now they had separate bedrooms, telling Olga's parents it was because of Daisy waking at night, though she rarely did. Olga wore the look of a disappointed woman, and Lev hardly cared. Joseph came in.
"Here's Grandpa," Lev said.
"Morning,"
Joseph said curtly. Daisy said,
"Grandpa wants a sandwich."
"No," said Lev. "They're too big for him."
Daisy was delighted when Lev said things that were obviously wrong.
No, they're not, she said. They're too small.
Joseph sat down. He had changed a lot, Lev had found on returning from the war. Joseph was overweight, and his striped suit was tight. He panted just from the exertion of walking downstairs. Muscle had turned to fat, black hair had gone grey, a pink complexion had become an unhealthy flush. Paulina came in from the kitchen with a pot of coffee and poured a cup for Joseph. He opened the Buffalo Advertiser. Lev said, "How's business?" It was not an idle question. The Volstead Act had come into force at midnight on January 16th, making it illegal to manufacture, transport, or sell intoxicating liquor. The Vyalov Empire was based on bars, hotels, and liquor wholesaling. Prohibition was the serpent in Lev's paradise. "We're dying," said Joseph with unusual frankness. "I've closed 5 bars in a week, and there's worse to come." Lev nodded. "I'm selling near beer in the clubs, but nobody wants it." The act permitted beer that was less than half of 1% alcohol. You have to drink a gallon to get a buzz. "We can sell a little hooch under the counter, but we can't get enough. And anyway, people are scared to buy." Olga was shocked. She knew little about the business.
"But Daddy, what are you going to do?"
"I don't know," said Joseph. This was another change. In the old days, Joseph would have planned ahead for such a crisis. Yet it was 3 months since the act had been passed, and in that time Joseph had done nothing to prepare for the new situation. Lev had been waiting for him to pull a rabbit out of a hat. Now he began to see, with dismay, that it was not going to happen. That was worrying. Lev had a wife, a mistress, and 2 children, all living off the proceeds of the Vyalov businesses. If the empire was going to collapse, Lev would need to make plans. Paulina called Olga to the phone and she went into the hallway. Lev could hear her speaking.
"Hello, Ruby," she said. "You're up early."
There was a pause.
"What? I don't believe it."
A long silence followed. Then Olga began to cry. Joseph looked up from the newspaper and said, "What the hell?" Olga hung up with a crash and came back into the dining room. With her eyes full of tears, she pointed at Lev and said,
"You bastard!
What did I do?"
he said, although he feared he knew.
You fucking bastard!
Daisy began to bawl. Joseph said,
"Olga, honey, what is the matter?"
Olga answered,
"She's had a baby."
Under his breath, Lev said,
"Oh, shit."
Joseph said,
"Who's had a baby?"
"Lev's whore. The one we saw in the park. Marga."
Joseph reddened.
"The singer from the Monte Carlo? She had Lev's baby?"
Olga nodded, sobbing. Joseph turned to Lev.
"You son of a bitch."
Lev said, "Let's all try to stay calm." Joseph stood up.
"My God, I thought I'd taught you a damned lesson."
Lev pushed back his chair and got to his feet. He backed away from Joseph, holding his arms out defensively.
"Just calm the fuck down, Joseph," he said. "Don't you dare tell me to calm down," Joseph said.
With surprising agility, he stepped forward and lashed out with a meaty fist. Lev was not quick enough to dodge the blow, and it struck him high on his left cheekbone. It hurt like hell, and he staggered back. Olga snatched up the howling Daisy and retreated to the doorway.
"Stop it!"
she yelled. Joseph lashed out with his left. It was a long time since Lev had been in a fistfight, but he had grown up in the slums of Petrograd, and the reflexes still operated. He blocked Joseph's swing, moved in close, and punched his father-in-law's belly with both fists in turn. The breath whooshed out of Joseph's chest. Then Lev struck at Joseph's face with short jabs, hitting the nose and mouth and eyes. Joseph was a strong man and a bully, but people were too scared of him to fight back, and for a long time he had had no practice at defending himself. He staggered back, holding up his arms in a feeble attempt to protect himself from Lev's blows. Lev's street-fighting instincts would not let him stop while his assailant was upright, and he kept after Joseph, punching his body and head, until the older man fell backward over a dining chair and hit the carpet. Olga's mother, Lena, came rushing into the room, screamed, and knelt beside her husband. Paulina and the cook came to the doorway to the kitchen, looking scared. Joseph's face was battered and bleeding, but he raised himself on his elbow and pushed Lena aside. Then, when he tried to get up, he cried out and fell back. His skin turned grey and he stopped breathing. Lev said,
"Jesus Christ."
Lena started to wail.
"Joseph, oh my Joe, open your eyes."
Lev felt Joseph's chest. There was no heartbeat. He picked up the wrist and could not find a pulse. I'm in trouble now, he thought. He stood up. Polina, call an ambulance. She went into the hall and picked up the phone. Lev stared at the body. He had to make a big decision fast. Stay here, protest innocence, pretend grief, try to wriggle out of it? No. The chances were too slim. He had to go. He ran upstairs and stripped off his shirt. He had come home from the war with a lot of gold, accumulated by selling scotch to the Cossacks. He had converted it to just over $5,000, stuffed the bills into his money belt, and taped the belt to the back of a drawer. Now he fastened the belt around his waist and put his shirt and jacket back on. He put on his overcoat. On top of his wardrobe was an old duffel containing his U.S. Army officer's issue Colt 45 Model 1911 semi-automatic pistol. He stuffed the pistol into his coat pocket. He threw a box of ammunition and some underwear into the duffel, then he went downstairs. In the dining room, Lena had put a cushion under Joseph's head, but Joseph looked deader than ever. Olga was on the phone in the hallway, saying, "Be quick, please. I think he may die." "Too late, baby," Lev thought. He said, "The ambulance will take too long. I'm going to fetch Dr. Schwartz." No one asked why he was carrying a bag. He went to the garage and started Joseph's Packard Twin Six. He drove out of the property and turned north. He was not going to fetch Dr. Schwartz. He headed for Canada. Two. Lev drove fast. As he left Buffalo's northern suburbs behind, he tried to figure out how much time he had. The ambulance crew would undoubtedly call the police. As soon as the cops arrived, they would find out that Joseph had died in a fistfight. Olga would not hesitate to tell them who had knocked her father down. If she had not hated Lev before, she would now. At that point, Lev would be wanted for murder. There were normally three cars in the Vialov garage. The Packard, Lev's Ford Model T, and a blue Hudson used by Joseph's goons. It would not take the Flatfoots very long to deduce that Lev had left in the Packard. In an hour, Lev calculated, the police would be looking for the car. By then, with luck, he would be out of the country. He had driven to Canada with Marga several times. It was only 100 miles to Toronto, 3 hours in a fast car. They liked to check into a hotel as Mr. and Mrs. Peters and go out on the town, dressed to the nines, without having to worry about being spotted by someone who might tell Joseph Vialov. Lev did not have an American passport, but he knew several crossings where there were no border posts. He reached Toronto at midday and checked into a quiet hotel. He ordered a sandwich in the coffee shop and sat for a while contemplating his situation. He was wanted for murder. He had no home and he could not visit either of his two families without risking arrest. He might never see his children again. He had $5,000 in a money belt and a stolen car. He thought back to the boasts he had made to his brother only 10 months ago. What would Grigori think now? He ate his sandwich, then wandered aimlessly around the center of town feeling depressed. He went into a liquor store and bought a bottle of vodka to take back to his room. Maybe he would